Hello and welcome to Science Spinning, the show with an Irish spin on science with me, Sean Duke, here on 103.2 Dublin City FM. The Space Shuttle is due to embark on its last ever mission tomorrow morning, Friday, from NASA's Kennedy Space Center in Florida. So what did the shuttle achieve over its 35-year life, and what will now replace it? We'll be discussing the legacy of the shuttle and the implications of its termination for the future of space exploration with Frances McCarthy. She's an astronomer based at Blackrock Castle Observatory in Cork City. The way science is used to solve crime has, we all know from watching popular TV shows like CSI Miami, become ever more sophisticated. DNA from blood, semen or saliva that's left at the scene of a crime can, for example, often help to solve a case by establishing a link between perpetrator and victim. But another way to establish such a link is to look at the plants, the fungi, the pollen and the spores that are present at the scene or on a suspect. This additional layer of investigation has become more commonplace in UK crime investigations, though not yet in Ireland. Shortly, I'll be talking to Patricia Wilshire. She's a UK-based expert that will explain the value of examining plant and fungal materials as part of a criminal investigation. But first up, we're talking about the Space Shuttle, and I'm delighted to welcome Frances McCarthy to the programme. Hi, Frances.
And hello.
Well, Frances, you're originally from Canada, and you told me when we spoke before that you were 15 when the shuttle launched originally, and you saw most, or you know, followed a lot of its missions. So do you remember it fondly?
Absolutely. I can remember just how neat it was that this was the current latest and the newest and the brightest and the best way to get into space. You know, as a Canadian, the Canadians were responsible for putting the Canada arm onto the space shuttle, which was used in a few of the later missions. So this long robotic arm followed by Canada arm 2. This is from a country that so far has about 3 satellites.
Okay.
You know, so,
you know,
large Canadian flag sitting on this arm being used and regularly going up into space. It was very much the exciting part of watching space happening.
So would it be, you became an astronomer then later when you left school. Was this something that inspired you to do that, looking at these missions?
I think it kept me on the path. I think if I run it back, it was probably the Viking missions to Mars, which would have been in the mid-1970s, and then the Voyager mission off to the outer planets.
Yeah, because the picture, I remember those myself, the pictures came back and they were spectacular of Mars and, you know, the fact...
But it always perplexes me that there aren't a whole series of astronomers and space enthusiasts just kind of 5 or 10 years older than us, those who can remember the Apollo missions.
That's right. I don't remember that.
No. Complete blank for me as well.
Okay. Well, let's look at our generation here, the shuttle. It started under the Nixon administration. Of course, Kennedy was famous for getting the space program really going in the States.
Yeah.
But what was the thinking behind Nixon's move? It was $2.6 billion of a project in 1972.
He planned for original contracts for $2.6 billion.
Massive money then.
Yeah, they signed those original contracts in August of 1972. And he wanted a couple of things. He was saying it's going to be Space Transportation System, so that's the STS that you see in the introduction, the descriptions of the space shuttle now. They're STS and a number, and those are the flight details of it. And the idea was that the space frontier of the 70s was going to be familiar territory that humans can get to in the 80s and 90s.
Okay, so we're going to have, say, near space, I suppose, as our playground. We're
absolutely
going to transport
right.
things up and people and materials, etc.
Yeah, I mean, it was going to be just, it was going to make going to space just like catching, you know, catching a bus.
Okay.
You just head off and off you go, and you're working in space. Because if you think about it, the Apollo missions, they cost a little bit of money.
Sure. Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
They certainly came in at a fair old whack. By the time they were finally done, I think if you convert it into current money, it's $170 billion.
Right. Now, okay. When the shuttle was in the 70s, were there specific missions, like prestige missions and 80s, that it was involved, they were planned to be involved in?
Well, they were very much, they ran late, of course. There were a few kind of, the hangover of the Apollo mission was a couple of things, like Skylab came out of the Apollo mission. That went up in the sort of 74, 75 kind of time frame. And then the plan was, you know, a few years, take it easy, do these unmanned spacecraft while we work on the next manned missions. It was a little bit delayed. They eventually ended up going up with the first ones in 1981. So only 3 years late. Three years behind schedule. That's not too bad. And those first couple of ones, the first one up was Columbia. And it launched with a crew of two for the first few times, just testing, make sure it goes up and comes down.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, being this reusable craft, the shuttle orbiter itself is fully reusable. The two solid rocket boosters, they're reusable. But that big, large external tank, if you can kind of picture watching the shuttle go up, there's that big orange tank.
Mm-hmm.
That burns up every time.
Mm-hmm.
First couple of times they painted it, and that added weight. And then they realized they didn't need to paint it. It made no difference whether it was painted or not. So they left it kind of this orange color that it came. So that burns up every time, needs to be replaced fully. But they go and fish out the solid rocket boosters out of the ocean and use those again.
So they were moving towards a more reusable model after Apollo.
Yeah, I mean, that was the idea. Because the Apollo missions, you know, those, the Saturn rockets going up, shooting you up, those pretty much, some of them ended up kind of spiraling around the sun, going to orbit around the Earth. One of them showed up as an asteroid, was detected as a near-Earth object. And then they looked at the signature of the spectrum of it and discovered, oh, that's the paint.
Remember,
we thought that rocket went into the sun? Well, we found it again.
Yeah.
You know? So that was a kind of a recent revisit of one of those Saturn rockets.
Now, can you tell me, is it all to do with budget? Like, okay, tomorrow's the last one, it is expensive, but why is it coming to an end?
It's a little bit to do with budget. It's also a little bit to do with they lost two of them.
Sure, we remember those.
Yeah, you know, the Challenger, exploded on the way up, you know, so many seconds into flight with the loss of all lives.
This is 86, just for people.
Yeah, and this is in 1986.
Yeah.
And then Columbia, after they thought they'd kind of worked out the problems with launch and coming back is easy, well, Columbia was lost in 2003.
Mm-hmm.
And again, destroyed on re-entry into the atmosphere, all lives lost. So they had two cases where the requirement for human safety with technology from the 1970s really didn't connect. And I don't believe that NASA in 1972 intended to keep them going.
Mm-hmm.
In 40 years' time, we'll still be flying the same shuttle.
Sure, yeah, because 35 years is a long time.
You know, that's a lot of forward planning. They did actually put in place, you know, sort of about 10, 15 years ago, plans to build a new replacement for it, and that was called the Constellation Program, but then that had its budget cut.
Okay.
And it got cancelled last year.
Okay, so tomorrow it's due to go up, and it's going up to resupply the International Space Station with whatever they need up there.
Absolutely, yeah. But, and the shuttles were instrumental in building the space station. The space station could not have been built without the shuttles.
Yeah. Because they needed to get materials and people up.
Yep, and particularly the shuttle was designed to carry crew and materials and is considered sort of a heavy lifter. It takes the big stuff up. There are plenty of other rockets to take things up, but this was the workhorse of it, really able to carry the large size and large modules that are needed.
So now, what's going to supply that International Space Station now?
Well, this is it. The Russians have their own rockets.
Mm-hmm.
So the Soyuz mission, those are all grand to be heading up on their own rockets. But NASA actually has gone for a commercial resupply contract. So they've awarded contracts with a couple of American companies for commercial cargo services. All right. So
okay.
The time
this is a big change.
This is kind of cool, isn't it?
Mm.
And the time that these were awarded, which is a few years ago now, these were awarded back in 2008. One is for 8 flights, valued at $1.9 billion, and the other one is for 12 flights, valued at about $1.6 billion.
Okay.
So how about that? And it's fixed price.
Right.
Indefinite delivery. Indefinite quantity. So NASA can kind of say, look, you signed the contracts. This is what we want you to take.
Yeah.
You've said you'll do it.
Yeah.
All right. And the idea is a minimum of 20 tons of material up.
Okay. So commercial contractors are well able to do this now,
obviously. They can do this. And if they don't have to worry about taking people, your safety standard is allowed to be lower.
Mm-hmm.
So I have the feeling that these are going to be, this is the cargo going up, and the humans are going to go up in the Russian, well-developed, well-established. They've had their tragedies, but they were in the past, and they kind of worked out and have got a reliable rocket now.
Mm-hmm. And they have a pretty good safety record for the last couple of decades.
Yeah, they do. They do. Mm-hmm. They had their tragedy during the 1960s when it was all the target was going to the moon.
Yeah.
So they had an astronaut who was, you know, launched into orbit and just couldn't make it back, and knew it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, was stuck up in the in orbit around the Earth, knowing that as soon as they went for re-entry, it was not going to work.
I knew that. That's it.
Yeah.
Who was that person?
I'm trying to remember the name. I'm just trying to remember the name. It was Yuri Gagarin was the backup for that flight.
Okay.
And by all accounts, he showed up at the launch pad and demanded to be allowed to go.
Yeah.
And they put him off saying, no, you're the hero of the Soviet Union. You can't be doing it. We can't risk losing you.
Lucky man.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so just to finish off then, in terms of, say, the next couple of decades in space, I mean, they're talking about going to the moon again, going to Mars. I mean, what do you think, if you were to try and paint a picture for people, are we going to establish some kind of base on the moon and then go to Mars? Or how is it going to work?
I think, you know, a lot of the NASA and associated companies that work with them, you know, are picking up on this thing. This was a George Bushism from about 2003. We're going to go to the Mars.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of steps to do it. And given that the budget that was originally assigned to this was kind of $9 billion was spent in trying to develop this constellation project, and a new human carrying craft called Orion, that budget got canceled because they said, really? We've got new technology here. We can't predict how much it's going to cost us. Like, yes, you've given us $9 or $10 billion to kind of work on it now, but we're going to need more. So it got canceled. And now they're kind of coming back with a new policy, but again, not quite enough money that NASA say they need to develop something that is going to be absolutely safe for humans.
Mm-hmm. You know, like what I'm saying, I guess, is could we have some kind of new transport system that makes it easier to travel between Earth and the moon?
I think those of us who've read plenty of science fiction, we've read how it's going to happen. There's going to be rail guns, there's going to be all sorts of stuff. Generally, what we have now are big rockets burning lots of fuel.
Yeah.
One of the approaches that is being strongly pushed is that you do one thing for humans and another thing for cargo. And things like the Space Shuttle Launch System was designed to do both.
Right.
If you split it out, it becomes a lot easier.
Okay, and that's where we're headed.
Yeah,
I'm just
going
to have to finish off there, Francis.
Yeah.
But listen, thanks very much for coming on and telling us all about the shuttle, and maybe we can have you on again to talk about...
Well, I'm really hoping that the weather forecast for Kennedy eases, and it does actually launch tomorrow, because we've planned to do a whole event down here at the observatory to watch NASA TV and see it heading off.
Okay, and I should say it's Blackrock Castle Observatory, which is in Cork City, isn't it? What's your website if people want
to? We're at bco.ie.
bco.ie. Okay, thanks a lot, Francis.
Thanks very much.
Talk to you again. Bye-bye. Okay, in science news this week, just an item here while we're keying up our next guest. I thought it was interesting. Findings from Israel this week support the long-held opinion or view that sports can help ease aggression, particularly in boys. So we know, obviously, that a lot of boys, all boys schools, are very keen on sport, and some parents think maybe the emphasis on sport in certain schools might be too much. But it's interesting that, as is often the case, the kids, the children, the boys that do well are in sport do well academically too. So this study anyway involved 349 children, so that's quite a lot. They were from the lower, poorer backgrounds, and they got them to do a strict program of sports three times a week. They played team sports like basketball or soccer, and twice a week they were doing martial arts, judo, karate, those kind of sports. So there was over a 24-week program. And what they found was that at the end of that, the participants themselves reported that they had greater self-control, problem-solving skills, even delayed gratification, where, you know, you don't just do something immediately. You can actually, for example, you can study hard to get into college, and the gratification that comes later of getting into college. So they found, interestingly, that there was little change in the female population. So certainly for boys, it seems that this connection with sport provides them with a sense of purpose and decreases the likelihood they will act out their behavioural problems. Now, the next thing that we're going to talk about, this area of forensic palynology, which is essentially how forensic scientists are now using pollen and spores and fungi, different materials, as part of investigations. So I'm now going to talk to an expert in this particular area, Patricia Wilshire. She's a UK-based researcher and she's been looking at this area for several years. Hi, Patricia. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
So maybe you can give people, listeners here in Dublin, kind of an overview of this whole area and how it's come into forensic cases over the last, say, 10 or 20 years?
Well, it's quite well established now. I started about 18 years ago in England, although I'm Welsh, actually. Mm-hmm. And it's just gone bigger and bigger, and I've been involved with most of the high profile cases in recent years in Britain, and it's been very, very successful in tracing offenders to crime scenes and many other things too.
Okay, and is Britain one of the leaders in this field, or are other countries very active in it too?
Yes, I would say that we are now the leaders, although it has been going on much longer in New Zealand. The New Zealanders, there's one person there in particular, he's been doing forensic palynology. This is the study of pollen grains, plant spores and fungal spores for longer than that. But we have developed it slightly more broadly in that we go into mortuaries and do a lot of crime scene work, whereas they do much less of that. Well, they don't do any of the mortuary work in New Zealand, as far as I know.
Okay. So tell us, in what kind of cases, let's take murder cases. I know you can't talk about specific cases, but that's fine. But in general, what can pollen and spores tell us about a murder case, potentially? How can they help to solve?
A great deal, really, because pollen grains and spores and fungal spores are just about everywhere. There are some places where they're not very frequent, but normally when you walk around the environment, you do pick them up on your clothes, on your shoes, in your hair, and so on. And you don't see them, you don't know they're there, and they're jolly difficult to get rid of. And, of course, if you've been to a crime scene, and we extract all the particulates from you, we can tell that you've been to that place because the vegetation there is very, very specific, and that specific profile will be reflected in you, and we can trace you back to that place. Now, people are very surprised at this. They think, oh, look, it's a hedge.
Yeah.
That hedge looks just like the hedge a mile down the road, but they won't be the same. It will be quite unique.
So let's just imagine it was in Ireland here. So if there was a murder committed in say, County Wicklow here beside Dublin, would you be able to pretty closely determine if a suspect was at the scene?
It's not as easy as that. Obviously,
yeah.
Nothing is ever as easy as that. But if you had a particular place in County Wicklow and that place were known, and we had samples from that place, and I was able to go there and look at all the vegetation and so on there and take samples from it, I could then compare those samples with samples taken from the suspect and compare them. And then what I would do is look at all sorts of other places that that person might have been for elimination purposes. So then we can say, look, we've been to all these other places too, but that is the one that matches.
Would you have to typically go to the suspect's home? Because I'd imagine they'd change their clothes and get rid of their clothes or whatever if they'd any sense, and try and clean themselves up after committing such a crime.
Yes, well, yes, that's an area I don't really want to go into very much. But I would go to their home anyway, because I'd need to eliminate it as being the source of all the evidence, wouldn't I?
Sure, sure. Okay. So there's other types as well. There's fungi. Well, that's, I suppose, spores you're talking about,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes, fungal spores. So they're very important, and actually, it's my husband that identifies those. He's a mycologist. And although they're in the same samples that we look at for pollen and plant spores, so we know they're from exactly the same place. And again, when you're walking around, you don't realize it, but you're picking up all sorts of things. I mean, if you look, for example, the next time you walk through the woods and you look at some dead oak leaves, you will see lots of little black dots on those oak leaves. They're invariably there. And those little black dots are fruiting bodies of fungi that are spewing out spores, and you pick them up.
Yeah.
And you're picking up things from all over the place, really. And we know the habits of the fungi. We know where they live. We know how they live.
We know what the likelihood is that you're going to find them in certain places, and so we can build up a picture of where people have been.
Okay, and presumably if a body has been moved from one place to another, you can also determine that.
Yes, we can, because I have done this very frequently. I would then look at the corpse in the mortuary, and I would take samples from the mortuary, and if the samples from the corpse didn't match, or there was certainly another place superimposed on the place, the first place,
yeah,
then I would be able to say, well, this corpse has been in two places. I know one place where it was found. I can eliminate that now. There must be another place. And if there's enough information there, I can predict the sort of place it will be. And in actual fact, I've been able to find bodies in different parts of Britain without even leaving my study.
Oh, okay. How does that work exactly? Sorry, tell us more. Well, or you can't tell us specific.
Well, I can't tell you too much, but yeah. I mean, basically, I would. We get samples from some suspect, and,
yeah.
And we're looking for a body, and then...
There's no body, so typically the case is kind of running up against a brick wall, like,
yes,
you know, without a body.
That's right, there's no body, but we've got samples from some suspect or some suspicious item,
yeah,
and I would look at the assemblages of plants and fungi in that assemblage, and we would count them, and we would build up a profile. I close my eyes, and because we know the plants and we know the sorts of place they grow and the assemblages in which they grow, I can envisage the sort of place that we're looking at.
Right, and how you would then narrow it down, obviously, to an area.
Yes, well, I mean, it's quite exciting, really.
Because it is.
Well, we know what sorts of soils, you see, the plants grow on. So because we know the sorts of soils, I can predict the geology as well. So if we look at the geology map, I can say, oh, we can forget that area because it's too chalky.
Okay.
Or we can forget that area, it's too acidic, and so on. And so we can limit the number of places that we need to look. And then we're looking for specific kinds of places within a restricted area. We might need the help of a local botanist because they might know the area,
sure,
much more intimately than I would. And I can say, I'm looking for a place like this that's got this, 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 and this.
Yeah.
Oh, I know a place like that. And then we could go and investigate. And in that way, I found several bodies for the police.
So this has happened more than once. This has happened a few times.
This has happened.
Wow, that's great. So you must be able to narrow it down pretty narrowly, if you like, to a specific,
well,
fairly specific,
I mean,
area.
Yes, you do. But sometimes, in one case, it was very specific. But in fact, it didn't need any other help other than my description. As I described things, the police, when they eventually located this place, saw it. They could wander through the woods and find it. Other cases where it's been slightly more general, the dogs have gone in, the sniffer dogs, and then of course they've got the scent, and then they can locate the remains.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a fascinating area. I'm sure there's people listening thinking that's a great job. Is it a glamorous job, the one that you look forward to every day?
No.
It's
not a bit like CSI.
Okay, that's, yeah.
It's not even remotely glamorous. And to do it really, you need to have been analysing vegetation. You need to be a botanist, really. And you need to have done palynology for many, many years. I mean, I've got 40 years of experience. You can't just go to university, do a botany degree, a bit of palynology, and be able to do it. Because you have to, for years, experienced environments to be able to visualise them.
Well, Patricia, thanks for coming on, and your Welsh accent is still there, but I can hear it strongly.
Oh,
oh yes, definitely. And thanks very much for coming on and telling us about your career studying pollen and spores in crime fighting. Thanks, Patricia.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, that's all we've time for this week, folks. If you'd like to find out more about what's happening in the world of science in Ireland and beyond, then why not check out my Science Spinning website at seanduke.com. The site has all the podcasts from previous Science Spinning shows, as well as opinion pieces, profiles of our Irish scientific greats, features of various kinds, scientific mysteries, and lots more. If you want to contact me here at the show, please email me at sciencespinning@dublincityfm.ie. I'd be delighted to hear from you, whether it's feedback on the show or a suggestion for a science story that you feel is worth telling. So tune in again next week at 3:30 here on 103.2 Dublin City FM for another edition of Science Spinning. And bye-bye for now.